to welcome to the stage Peter Tetchell.
Thank you very much. I guess my starting point tonight is the recognition that free market capitalism is failing Britain and the world. In Britain today, the richest 1,000 individuals have a combined personal wealth of £460 billion. And they've increased that wealth during the recession. Now, these may be very skilled and talented individuals, or they just may be very cunning and greedy. Whatever, I doubt very much that they are worth the extraordinary wealth that they have amassed. At the same time, we have the opening of food banks in 2014 to feed hungry, impoverished families. If we look globally, we see the same pattern of huge wealth amassed in a handful of very rich, powerful countries and mass impoverishment for most of the world's people. This morning, today, over 800 million people have no safe, clean drinking water. Over 800 million are malnourished, if not starving. So quite clearly, the global economic system as it exists has failed. It isn't working. We need to change the system. The question is how. Now, in my view, there is no conflict between democracy and socialism. To me, socialism is essentially about the extension of democracy to the economic realm. It's taking democracy into the economic sphere. We all expect political democracy. Why not economic democracy as well? If we take a look at our economic system, we see that we live in a system of economic dictatorship. There is very little democracy, participation, transparency, or accountability in the way the economy is run. Employees and the wider public are frozen out of economic decision-making. All the votes, all the power is concentrated in the hands of a small minority of major shareholders, directors, and managers.
Big business rules. They have total power. They have the power to make all those decisions about hiring and firing, pricing and wages, health and safety. The whole issue, every issue of the economy, is decided by the captains of industry. Employees and the wider public are frozen out. Now, my argument is that in the economic system, we have a contradiction with our political system. In the political system, we have one person, one vote. Of course, the political system is not perfect. We have an unfair voting system, first past the post, which is rigged in favour of three main parties. But nevertheless, the principle is there, one person, one vote. That principle does not translate into the economic system. The economic system is not one person, one vote. It's a tiny minority, all the votes, and the vast majority, no votes. So that is the fundamental issue. How do we extend democracy, not only politically to make it better, but also extend it economically to ensure the economic enfranchisement of the mass of people? I don't have all the answers, let alone the blueprint. But I want to suggest tonight some of the fragments of what an alternative economy might look like. What an alternative socialized economy might look like. And although they are not a future economic system per se, these are perhaps the ideas or policies that are the seeds, the embryo, of a long transition from what we have now, free market capitalism, to a socialist or socialized economy. And I want to suggest four very practical, tangible, achievable ideas. Things that can be realistically put into effect. The first is the idea that we should make corporate recklessness and negligence an explicit criminal offence. So that if the bosses of industry behave in a way that is negligent and reckless and irresponsible, they should be held personally liable. We all know that in lots of professions, the medical profession, the legal profession, and so on, there is a code of ethics and conduct, and practitioners who violate it can be disciplined and even struck off. What I'd like to do is see a system where similar penalties apply to big business, where they behave in a reckless way, they should be personally held accountable, with the prospect of very large fines and even, in extreme cases, prison sentences. Now you can bet that if such a policy, such an offence, was law 10 years ago, the bosses of RBS and Northern Rock would not have taken the reckless decisions they did. If they thought that they could be held personally liable for the losses their reckless policies resulted in, and even sent to prison, they would not have made those decisions. So what I'm saying is, by making corporate recklessness and negligence a specific criminal offence, it acts as a constraint on the power of capital. It acts as a safeguard against irresponsible decisions. Yes, it is not socialist, but it is a way in which we move towards greater checks and balances on the power of big business and ensure that within a certain framework, it acts in a more responsible way. The other proposal I would suggest is the idea that we should require all medium and large size companies and public institutions like the National Health Service to have on their management boards at least one third employee elected directors and independent directors appointed to represent the interests of consumers. This is sort of an extension of the German Works Council model, which I think would incline a workplace to greater fairness and responsibility. It would result in a different ethos in the boardroom. The moment the management boards are largely beholden to the key directors and shareholders and managers. Under this system, there would be a direct input from the workforce and the wider consumer public. Their interests would be represented at board level. They would have access to all corporate information. They would have voting rights. They have the power to bring forward resolutions. They would have the power to report to shareholder meetings. They have the power to blow the whistle on corporate bosses where they made decisions that were wrong and damaging. To have that influence, to have that power, would be a very important extension of the rights of working people and the wider public. Another idea is to break up the unhealthy concentration and centralization of political power, I'd like to see employee-neutral societies established and given statutory control of employees' pension funds. This would help decentralize and democratize investment decision-making and give it a stronger social dimension. As you know, currently about £900 billion invested in UK pension funds account for about one third of the entire stock market. If this was in the hands of employee mutual societies, it would be a very important counterweight to the influence and the power of big business. Of course, the employee mutual societies would appoint financial experts to run the pension funds, but they would do so within the ethical framework decided by the employee, decided by the members. And while there is no guarantee that this would result in more ethical investment, I suspect that most employees would probably be less inclined to invest in the arms trade and sweatshop labour, and more inclined to invest in socially useful production. And if these employee societies were established on a regional basis, they could use their employee mutual contributions to invest in local regional economies. So they could address local needs through a locally run pension fund by employee mutual societies. So instead of all the money drained to London and the South East, instead of it flying abroad, employees in a region would know and understand the economic deprivations and needs of their particular region, and would know that it would be in their interest, the interest of their families and communities, to use their investment power in ways that can uplift that region and remedy those problems. Another idea would be to, again, devolve and decentralise economic power by having a mechanism for employee share ownership, collectively administered and held on behalf of all staff in an institution, again, by employee mutual societies. This is an idea, of course, was first developed by the socialist Swedish economist Rudolf Meidner in the 1970s. He proposed, and I endorse the view, that private share companies would be obliged by law to assign a portion of their annual profits in the form of new share issue to their employees. So if a company's profits went up, by law, employees would have to share in a percentage of those profits in the form of new share issue. So over time, employees would gain increasing share ownership of their own company and could use that share ownership to influence the decisions of their company and how it decided to invest, its health and safety, environmental responsibilities, and so on. It would ensure, in a different way, that employees would be able to have a meaningful say in the running of the enterprises and indirectly to the wider economy. Now, these four elements of a new economic governance would not only redistribute economic power in favour of employees and consumers, and build an alliance between workers and consumers. It would also decentralise economic power, democratise economic decision making, improve corporate social responsibility, and strengthen the accountability of businesses to their employees and consumers. It is a structural reform of capitalism. Not a reform like increasing wages or improved health and safety. Those reforms can be easily accommodated within the existing structures of a free market system. These reforms are about the structural transformation of capitalism. They are not a revolution, they are not an overnight transformation, but they are pushing at the boundaries and, on the one hand, weakening the power of capital and strengthening the power of labour. They are moving the system in a socialist or socialised direction. And of course, there are two theories about socialism. One is about you have an armed or popular revolution. The other is, of course, that cumulative structural reforms get you to the same place eventually. For example, in this country, there was no single break from feudalism to capitalism. There was no single revolution that made that transition. What happened in Britain and many other societies, the transition from feudalism to capitalism, took place over 300 or 400 years through a succession of reforms, which ultimately meant that feudalism was no more and that capitalism reigned supreme. What I'm suggesting is the same ethos, the same mechanism can apply in the transition from capitalism to socialism. If we have a peaceful, non-violent, popular uprising to install socialism, I'd be first on the front line. But as we know, that is very unlikely to happen despite the splendid efforts and endeavours of many people over many decades. So therefore we have to look, in the meantime, at other mechanisms to push our society in a more socialised and socialist direction. It isn't going to be answer. There are many minds greater than mine who will probably come up with much better ideas. But these four ideas, I think, are the beginnings, or the potential beginnings, of that transition. I refer back to the great Italian communist Togliatti. He had similar ideas. He argued against the traditional Leninist point of view that structural reforms of capitalism, reforms which changed the way in which economic decision-making was made, were the Italian road to socialism and communism. I think he was onto something. And tonight I presented you with four ideas, four practical, achievable ideas that if they're argued for, if they're publicised, if they're campaigned for, can be won. These are not black dreams. These are not utopian never-nevers. I've done this talk hundreds of times around the country over the last 10 or 20 years, and it's amazing how many people, even quite conservative people who regard themselves as not socialists, think that this is a practical, achievable goal, that it's about fairness and justice, and that it's ultimately about creating a more cohesive, inclusive society. They may be right, they may be wrong, but I offer you these proposals for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. We all live today in a society which is shabby, tawdry, alienated, impoverished, irrational, brutal, cheap, murderous, callous, and anti-human. And yet against all the odds, the essential helpfulness and cooperation of human beings towards one another constantly shines out. The human rights abuses which Peter Thatcher has spent so many years campaigning against are an inevitable product of a class-divided society. And the only way forward for us now is to challenge the reality which lies at the heart and the core of this system under which we all live, and which is currently denying us our essential humanity. What does human society consist of? About 7 billion people across the earth, all needing food, shelter, clothing, travel, education, health, entertainment. The most compelling project facing mankind is the rational use of the resources we have in order to meet those needs. Nothing can be more simple. That is the human project. To make the technology we have work for all. To gear our production of wealth and our social mechanisms to meet all of those human needs throughout the world. It has long been the case that we have the resources to do that. And I'm going to come on a bit later to give a few examples of that. We do have the natural and technological resources to feed and clothe and house several times the current world population. However, there is one obstacle which must be removed before that simple goal can be enjoyed. At the present time, The bulk of this world's resources are locked away from us. They are actually under armed guard, ruthlessly controlled by a tiny minority who stop at nothing to cling on to those resources and that power, and who can only ever use them for their own further empowerment. Now, Peter did start his opening comments by mentioning one or two of the statistics of deprivation under which we live, but I'm going to focus on this perhaps in slightly more detail, because I think it's pretty essential for us tonight to really get a feel for the extent of the problem of inequality that we're actually grappling with here. And I'm going to start by looking at a random and fairly typical statistic. This is that in the UK, the richest 1,000 people, to whom Peter also referred, that's just 1 in 30,000 of the adult population, have actually been increasing their wealth in recent years at an extraordinary rate, despite talk of recession. This small group of 1,000 people holds assets between them, which average out at nearly £500 million worth each. And of course, within those 1,000 people, there lies an even greater concentration. For example, the top 500 have more than twice as much as the other 500, and so on. In the last 15 years, those 1,000 people to whom we both referred have seen their total wealth increase by £315 billion worth. Even in just the last 3 years, their wealth has increased by £155 billion. That's more than the entire UK budget deficit. And we're not just talking about their wealth, but simply the amount that they've gained in the past 3 years is greater than the entire national debt. These huge, mind-boggling amounts of rapidly growing wealth in very, very few hands are not just statistics to play with. These figures represent actual control of society's resources, minerals, land, machinery. It also involves the control of the vast army of human labour, which they proceed to purchase day by day in order to generate further surpluses for themselves. As far as recession biting in recent years, the website businessandfinance.com has quoted one Irish businessman as saying that he has been busy pursuing the unique opportunities and value resulting from the downturn. But where do these huge surpluses come from? Where does all this extra wealth flow from, which is accruing more and more intensely in the hands of this tiny number of people? There is only one source of social wealth and value in the world. These surpluses are coming from the constant hard work of the 99% who don't hold such social power, who are forced to go out and work for wages and salaries year after year because they have no other option. The joint efforts of people like ourselves. So as long as this extraordinary set of social relationships continues, there is little point in discussing what we should do with society's resources. Let's not keep the discussion too Anglo-centric. Obviously, these extraordinary figures are not limited to Britain. If we move on to the international scale and look at Forbes magazine's international research and report on the global situation, around the world there are 1,500 billionaires. Their net worth also increased. The past year alone, the world's 1,500 billionaires have increased their wealth from $4.6 to $5.4 trillion. So that's over 5 million million. And again, a tiny number of people, only several times the number of people in this small hall. Let's be under no illusion. If any individual people try to access any of those resources, whether it be land, factories, transport, or any kind of state in that industry, that 1% or smaller than 1% have never had any hesitation in using the brutal armed force of the state or of private militias to deal with such a transgression. If we try to access the resources of the earth, we will be threatened with armed force. Generally speaking, that use of violent force will be quite legitimate. It's legitimate in the sense that in most parts of the world today, the electorate has given their permission, their acquiescence to this state of affairs. However passive, by voicing the views that this system of property relationships is the only way in which society can be run, at least in the foreseeable future. And that's a point of view which we as socialists are very concerned to confront and deal with and bring to an end. And it's a view which we'll see as the discussion this evening moves on, I believe, has already been voiced once this evening. The Socialist Party, in contrast, is very clear about this. The current set of social relationships is not the only way that we can run the world. In the foreseeable future, we don't have to actually make compromises or little baby steps with tinkering with the capitalist mechanics. We do have the option of discussing genuine alternatives. Who's the richest man in the world? It used to be Bill Gates, but it's no longer Bill Gates. It's now Carlos Slim of the world of Mexican telecoms. And his individual wealth is now estimated at $73,000 million. Even his wealth has increased enormously in the past year, by some 17%. That one man's resources represent a huge chunk of the Earth's wealth and natural ability to generate more wealth. Even if you were to take Slim's gargantuan fortune and invest it in a simple high street bank, you would end up receiving £15 million every single day in interest, without having to go to work. Meanwhile, the rest of us don't get that amount in an entire lifetime of actually going out to work. One recent report from Oxfam shows that the richest 85 people in the world, just one busload, own as much as £1 trillion, which is as much as the poorest 3.5 billion people. And the Oxfam researchers believe that it's likely wealth ownership is even more skewed than that, with more than £11 trillion held unreported and offshore. Again, we have this recurring theme about the concentration of wealth and resources on the planet outstripping even the wildest imagination or estimates that you might have had for that. Meanwhile, 7 in every 10 people in the world live in countries where inequality has increased since the 1980s. Now, coming back to our own day-to-day lives, for over 99% of the population, the largest transaction that we ever enter into throughout our lifetime, if at all, is to muster all of our resources to implore those with wealth to lend us a mere few £100,000 with which we might secure our individual housing. A few £100,000. Let's go back to Carlos Slim with his $73,000 million. On what terms would Carlos Slim allow us access to, for example, let's just say 10% of his wealth, $7,300 million, so that we can start producing food, housing, and other resources for those who need them? The answer is very simple. Never. He uses violent force, armed guard, to protect that slice of the planet which is his. Now, at this juncture, I hasten to stress that this issue about pinpointing the extreme concentration of wealth in few hands, this has nothing to do with jealousy, bitterness, envy towards his people. The reason these things matter to us is that the ownership of the planet by this tiny number of people is the same fact as our poverty and inability to make a rational use of the planet's resources. Technology has been advancing exponentially, and yet social relationships have not kept pace. We are still stuck in the outdated model of employment, wage labour, salaried labour, which allows those few individuals to use that mechanism to accumulate more and more capital in their hands. And that capital, as I've said, is supplied by the unpaid labour of the working class majority. So we have to end capitalism before we can begin to discuss using those resources rationally. Now, I've mentioned the C word, capitalism, which is so often misused. What is capitalism? It's not a tendency. It's not an attitude. It's not a style of life. It's not even a political regime. Capitalism is an actual system which either exists or does not exist. And at the present time, that system exists throughout the entire planet. Capitalism is a concrete set of social relationships embodied in law which exists throughout the world today. And what are its key features? First, class division. 1% of the population own and control almost all productive resources, whilst the rest of us work for wages or salaries, working for that tiny minority, directly or indirectly, in order to create further wealth for them. And there's a simple trick at the heart of capitalism, which is that the amount of wealth on average that one worker can help to generate in a working week far outstrips the amount that is paid to him or her in terms of wages or salaries on which we are expected to live. There is this built-in surplus which accrues legally and automatically to the private owners of capital, or in many cases the state bureaucrats who administer the state variety of capitalism, which for many years masqueraded in the East under the name of socialism so falsely, but in fact it was far more accurately referred to as state capitalism. The second feature of capitalism after the division into two classes is that wealth is produced not to be freely used by human beings, but to be bought and sold in a market financially in order to help the realisation of profit by that minority. So we have production geared towards profit, financial surpluses, not geared towards human need or use. This is capitalism. It exists everywhere and it has to go. It causes huge numbers of problems for all of us. What kind of problems does it cause? Well, firstly, of course, the relative impoverishment of the great majority who do all of the work. And that poverty ranges from the hundreds of millions who are literally starving to death, across to the billions of people, perhaps including ourselves, who instead have lives which are blighted by constant struggle, constant stress, in the face of potential abundance which we're being denied. It causes many other problems, of course, the constant wars or threats of wars, which are directly caused by capitalism, because its rival ruling groups and owners are fighting over the profit which they take. In different parts of the world, they enroll the rest of us to fight their battles to determine which of them controls the various minerals, lands, and trade advantages that they need to continue pillaging the world. In particular, capitalism has created a crisis in the very natural environment itself. Naomi Klein, writing in The New Statesman back in October, cited many of the world's most respected scientists all reaching the same conclusion that capitalism has to be swept aside if ecological catastrophes can be avoided. And she cites two of the world's leading scientific experts in that field, Anderson and Bose, who have reached the compelling conclusion that the only way in which a catastrophe can be averted now is by the most delicate fine-tuning and control, far from the expansion which capitalism drives towards in terms of emissions. And I'm going to quote from Naomi Klein in The New Statesman. She says, "This is fine, but we happen to have an economic system that fetishizes GDP growth above all else, regardless of the human or ecological consequences, in which it is considered anathema to plan or control production, since the market is the invisible genius to which everything must be entrusted." What Anderson and Bose are saying is that there is still time to avoid catastrophic warming, but not within the rules of capitalism as they are currently constructed. Anyone who sets out to look at society as we're doing tonight and to debate how we should live, or to campaign for change or human rights, has to ask three blindingly simple questions which must be considered and answered before all others. As I said earlier, we have about 7 billion human beings forming our human society, all of whom need to be simply fed, clothed, housed, provided with services for health, education, transport, exploration, creativity, entertainment. What resources do we have to fulfil this task? We've got the natural resources, the land, the crops, the minerals, the human labour, the machinery that we built. The World Health Organization and the United Nations have reported over and over again that the current resources could be sufficient to meet the needs of several times the population if properly developed. So the second question then is, what prevents that from happening right now? Well, as we see, ownership and control of the world's resources is in the hands of a tiny fraction of the population. They will allow access to those productive resources only under the most strict and antisocial of conditions, if and when further production will increase their wealth and their power further. So having answered the first question, we do have the resources to meet our needs. And having answered the second question, that what stops that from happening is capitalism, we have the third and final question of the night. Do we stand for the retention of that kind of regime? Or do we stand for its abolition? I'm sorry to say that everything Peter Thatcher has said accepts this anti-human system of minority control as being somehow inevitable, at least in the foreseeable future, for a very long foreseeable future. In the words of George Orwell in 1984, he seems to imagine a future in which a booted foot stamps on a human head forever. And all of these wide-eyed little schemes for persuading that ruthless minority to be nice without actually dispossessing them or without removing their wealth and power are the most unrealistic, utopian and idealistic waffle. We're on the outside looking in on the 1% who own and control the world, and we're being told that we should ask them to give us a small say, a one-third vote in how the planet's resources are run. This is a nonsensical contradiction, where you have brutal minority ownership. And because you're afraid of actually proposing getting rid of that, what you do instead is propose a kind of happy, popular participation. And what you're saying is that although we form 99% of the population, we're going to beg for a 33% say. Socialist solutions is very different from this. We say that we have to dispossess that minority legitimately, democratically, peacefully, on the basis of understanding and rejecting the whole capitalist system. This understanding and this action to end capitalism now must be that of a majority who will no longer look to politicians or leaders, but instead are developing the knowledge themselves to see through this huge con trick which has evolved. This lie that capitalism can somehow be improved or patched up. It's a very old lie, it's a very tired lie, and it's one which actually insults the intelligence of people who are suffering as we speak as a result of that lie. Revolution is not a wild idea, it's an imperative. And this is why. Human needs are not being met. Billions of children, men and women, are in varying degrees of starvation or deprivation. Even those of us in the most developed parts of the world are working for salaries or wages or surviving on benefits and continue to be exploited and to face a huge array of unnecessary problems. But in order to meet human needs universally and comfortably, we need first to repossess the earth which we inhabit. And to do that, we must first dispossess the minority who currently own and control it. This obviously necessitates a complete revolution in society. And the democratic use of what structures we currently have would be purely to enact that change. The only groundwork that we can lay for that revolution is the education of ourselves and our fellow workers to recognise that capitalism has had its day. It does not serve our needs any further in any of its forms. The United Nations who I mentioned, reports from the United Nations. And I'm going to quote from one of those reports as I move towards a close. They say, and I quote, "Growth in world cereal production has steadily outstripped world population growth. Yet each year there are more people in the world who do not get enough food. Global agriculture has the potential to grow enough food for all, but food is often not available where it is needed." Against that background of absurd contradictions, the socialist solution is blindingly simple. Socialism means the common ownership, the democratic control of all productive resources throughout the earth. It means an ultimate political and economic democracy in which, far from tinkering with the mechanics of business, we actually take over the world and all of its resources and run it in order to produce not for profit but for human use and for human need. That's the only goal worth discussing, worth campaigning for, worth persuading one another as being on the agenda now. That is the socialist aim which will solve the problems we're looking at tonight.